Good day and welcome to the American Constitution Society, How Fair Courts Can Prevent More Debacles Like Oklahoma conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Jeremy Leming. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. This is Jeremy Leming, Vice President of Communications of the American Constitution Society. And today we have a couple of experts with us to talk about the situation that unfolded in Oklahoma recently, where the Oklahoma Supreme Court was unable to stop some executions from going forward. The Oklahoma Supreme Court had initially placed stays on these executions in order to try to determine whether the new drug combination used to put death row inmates, to execute death row inmates, did not violate constitutional law, state and federal. And today we have Dahlia Lithwick with us. She's a longtime reporter on law and courts at Slate. And we also have Megan McCracken. She's the Eighth Amendment Resource Counsel at UC Berkeley School of Law's Death Penalty Clinic. I'd like to get the conversation started off with Dahlia first. Dahlia, can you take us through why this situation is so important in exposing some troubling aspects of the many states that use chemical combinations to kill death row inmates?
Sure. thank you so much, Jeremy, and to ACS, and to folks who've called in. It's really it's such an important topic, and I'm honored to be on this call with Megan. In effect, the reason this botched execution matters, and I a little bit balk at the word botched execution, it sounds like just a mistake. This was way beyond just a little mistake. But the reason that it matters isn't the reason that folks think it matters. People say it matters because this gruesome 50-minute agonizing, you know, death that went wrong, they had to close the blinds so that the spectators couldn't see it going wrong. It just looked horrible. But what I want to suggest to you today is actually about 7% of lethal injection executions go awry in this fashion. This is not that uncommon. I think this is an important execution not because of what happened, but because it throws a light upon what's happening persistently and regularly around the country in other lethal injection states, things that we don't notice. So I just want to talk briefly about, one, the secrecy with which the lethal injection protocols are beginning to be shrouded in and why that was a problem in Oklahoma. And then I want to talk about the very, very dramatic efforts in Oklahoma to usurp judicial integrity and judicial independence and what that meant, not only in Oklahoma, but what it means around the country. So the facts are pretty much as Jeremy outlined them. Clayton Lockett, clearly guilty. He shot a 19-year-old watch as she was buried alive. He is, you know, insofar as you can say there's a good candidate for the death penalty, he certainly, I guess, was a good candidate. There's absolutely no claim in this case that he was factually innocent or that there was prosecutorial misconduct or that he had poor representation, which are the kinds of things that beset so many capital defendants. He was guilty, and it was a horrible murder. It became a national story for these two reasons. One was the secrecy with which the state's death penalty protocols had been wrapped up. And to just say it very briefly, I think Megan will say more about it. Since about 2011, one of the three drugs in the so-called three-drug cocktail that is used in lethal injection jurisdictions has just become unavailable in the United States. American suppliers stopped producing it, and European suppliers felt that they simply would not ship it to American states if they were going to be used for capital punishment purposes. And because one of those three drugs has dried up, what the states have done is increasingly turn to other sources of these drugs, chiefly to these compounding pharmacies, which are unregulated pharmacies that kind of hand mix drugs for specific clients, but they're quite dramatically unregulated, for one thing, there tends to be real differences from batch to batch. It's not clear that there's any real standards across these compounding pharmacies. And the state more or less lowered an absolute curtain over the whole, not only where they got these drugs, but how they were using them, what the cocktails were, who was mixing them, who was administrating them. And so what we really have seen, and this is so important in the last couple of years, is that departments of corrections, not just in Oklahoma, but in Georgia, Louisiana, Missouri, Tennessee, and Texas, have just slammed the door on scrutiny of where these drugs are coming from and how they're being used. And so we've had time after time in recent years, lethal injections go horribly wrong because we don't know where the drugs are coming from, who's mixing them, who's administering them. Only very recently in Ohio, we had someone on death row who literally gasped and choked for 10 minutes in front of a horrified bunch of witnesses as he died as a result of these secret drugs. The protocol that was attempted in Oklahoma last week was one that had never been tried in the state before and was going to be tried for the first time. So I think there's a real argument being made that it's not an overstatement that these are becoming kind of experiments, that they're really being conducted for the first time on real live human beings, and there's no ability for their attorneys to access information about what's going on. So this brings us to the second part, which is in Oklahoma, attorneys for Clayton Lockett and Charles Warner, who were the two death row defendants who were going to be executed, by the way, both on one night, attorneys actually prevailed in persuading a district court judge that the secrecy was unconstitutional, that in effect it violated the Eighth Amendment ban on cruel and unusual punishment, and that they needed to halt the execution and find out more about this cocktail, the drugs, how they came up with it, and where it was coming from. And here it gets a little bit tricky. Oklahoma has a very unique two-tiered system of appeals courts. Civil appeals go to one court, criminal appeals go to another court. The court that typically hears criminal cases continued to decline to hear this case, but the Oklahoma Supreme Court took the case and said, you know, this is just such compelling issues. These are such important constitutional questions. We have to hear this case. As a matter of comity, they handed it back to the criminal appeals court. The criminal appeals court again declined to issue a stay. So in April, the Oklahoma Supreme Court, by a 5-4 margin, said, okay, we're staying the execution. We're not calling it off. We just have to kick this back to the criminal appeals court to find out if this protocol is permissible and what it is. Here's where it gets interesting. As you all probably know, Mary Fallon, the governor of Oklahoma, simply overrode the court and said they exceeded their jurisdiction, they don't have the jurisdiction to do this, and she reinstated the execution for the next week. And as though that wasn't bad enough, just to simply override the Supreme Court, that very day a member of the House of Representatives began drafting articles of impeachment to impeach the five justices who had voted to issue the stay. And this sounds like it's just, you know, amateur theatrics. It doesn't make that big of a difference. But in fact, it makes kind of a huge difference. And whether that played a role or not, all we know is that immediately the Oklahoma Supreme Court reversed itself and reinstated the execution date and said, you know what, we're out of it. This is not our problem. So what we saw happen was, in a kind of haste to execute these two men, not only did the governor simply disregard a Supreme Court directive to stop and take a breath and look at the protocols, but we also saw members of her legislature literally challenging the independence and the decision-making of a judicial branch in such a way that I think it's fair to say they were intimidated and they backed down. So I think I want to close just by saying that there are a lot of reasons to object to the death penalty, and we can talk about them or we cannot talk about them. You know, there's a study that only just came out last week suggesting that beyond everything we already know about DNA exonerations and innocence being executed, that as many as 4% of the folks currently on death row scheduled for execution are factually innocent. So we know there's a huge problem with that. We know there are massive racial imbalances between execution rates between blacks and whites in this country. We know that folks who kill whites far disproportionately more likely to be executed than folks who kill minorities. So there are so many entrenched and systemic problems with our capital system. But what's really important to me about what happened in Oklahoma last week is it raises very, very significant questions about, in this sort of haste to execute people secretly and behind a veil of almost complete inability to procure answers about what is happening, the state in this case really is, I think, accountable and responsible for pushing the courts out of the equation, forbidding the courts from doing what courts must do in Eighth Amendment cases, and committed just an enormous, enormous, enormous error.
And Dahlia, what kind of harm do you think Oklahoma has done to the idea of checks and balances? I mean, the Oklahoma Supreme Court was, you know, recognized that they needed to know more information about this combination of drugs and how they were going to be administered. They put a stay on it, and it's clear they buckled under political pressure. So what's the ramification? I guess, is it too early for us to know how much damage Oklahoma alone has done to separation of powers, checks and balances?
Well, I think that this is of a piece with what we're seeing around the country, just in terms of efforts to rein in state Supreme Court authority. And it manifests in all sorts of different ways. You'll recall that Iowa justices were recalled after unpopular decisions in same-sex marriage cases. The amount of money that pours into state Supreme Court races in order to unseat judges based on independent decisions they have made, often in just one case, and often on a panel of, you know, three, four, six people, but efforts to unseat judges based on decisions they've made have been dramatically, dramatically on the rise in the past couple of years, and I think this is of a piece with that. It's extremely cheap and easy to recall a state Supreme Court judge. If you don't like a decision that a state Supreme Court justice makes, it's really not a difficult enterprise to fund a mission to destroy them, either in a recall or in an upcoming election. And so I think this is really a part of, you know, National Center for State Court says this is the fourth time in 4 years that state Supreme Court justices have been threatened with an impeachment simply over a judicial decision they made. So I want to say this is an outlier, but it's not an outlier. It's really part of, I think, a quite systematic national attempt to either intimidate justices into towing the line or to punish justices who don't.
Yeah. And it appears in this case it went terribly awry. I mean, it ended up, it simply worked. The intimidation tactics appear to have worked, and to, I think, a great detriment to impartial courts. I'd like to get back to more of that discussion in a moment, but I'd like to move to get to Megan McCracken, the Eighth Amendment Resource Council for UC Berkeley School of Law, into this discussion. Megan, Oklahoma is, of course, not the only state using combinations of unknown drugs to execute people. They're also not the only state that tries to keep their protocol, the combination of drugs, and the methods secret. In fact, Judge Kermit Bayh of the Eighth Circuit has taken Missouri officials to task numerous occasions for trying to shroud their drug combinations in secrecy. He recently wrote that Missouri shields pharmacies and itself, quote, behind the hangman's cloak by refusing to disclose pertinent information to the inmates. Can you give us a broader view here as to what is going on in many other states that are using these drugs and their efforts to keep the public from providing much scrutiny?
Sure. So thank you, Jeremy and ACS, for having me, and thank you to all the callers for joining us, and thank you especially to Dahlia for that really stellar overview and perspective on this moment with lethal injection. I think as a little bit of a backdrop, one thing that's interesting and important to recognize is that right now with lethal injection practices, we see a degree of change and difference between the states, so change to lethal injection practices in the states and differences between state practices that we've never seen before. So whereas several years ago the states all used the same three drugs in a three-drug formula, there were differences. They had different doses and differences in the details of administration, but they all used thiopental, pancuronium bromide, and concentrated potassium chloride. Today we have states using one-drug protocols with compounded pentobarbital, and so the use of compounded drugs is one issue. We have states using two-drug protocols that are a combination of midazolam and hydromorphone. Within that drug formula, the states are using different doses of the two drugs, and they're really experimenting with this new combination of drugs. And then we see states still using three-drug formulas, some using the traditional, just without thiopental, which, as Dahlia mentioned, is no longer available. So using a three-drug combination with pentobarbital, the paralytic, and potassium chloride. Others are using midazolam in that first slot instead of pentobarbital. And then, again, between those protocols, wildly different doses and different methods of administration. And so there's just so many different practices and different novel drug combinations being used. So two of the issues to sort of draw out of that is the use of compounded drugs and then the use of these novel drug combinations, in particular midazolam mixed together with hydromorphone. While the states are using these new drug formulas, new dosages, new combinations, and really a lot of novel drug protocols and experimenting with, never having used them before, just to sort of, we're all waiting to see what's going to happen. While they're doing this, they are also intensifying the secrecy surrounding their procedures. And so whereas states have always shielded the identities of execution team members, they are now also shielding the identity of the drug suppliers, whether it be the manufacturer of a manufactured product, the seller of a manufactured product, or the compounding pharmacy that provides the compounded drugs. The states are refusing to turn over this information. We see this in Texas, Missouri, Oklahoma, Georgia. I think Dahlia mentioned all of this. They are really doubling down on that secrecy. And while they will say, or they have said, that it's to prevent harassment of their drug suppliers, it also prevents the courts from analyzing the legality and constitutionality of these execution procedures. Jeremy mentioned Judge Kermit Bayh's numerous dissents from the decisions in Missouri. So there we certainly see one judge taking the state to task, really calling the state out for protecting compounding pharmacies at the expense of really knowing exactly how they're carrying out execution. And we see in Oklahoma that this rush to execute Clayton Lockett and Charles Warner, we see this predictable consequence of shrouding your execution procedures in secrecy. And so that is the current landscape. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, it's got to be a major challenge here, because supporters of the death penalty, and even in the Lockett case, some comments have been said, his victim suffered terribly. The state executed him. It may have done so in a terrible manner, but what's the constitutional problem here? Are folks not? What do Oklahoma lawmakers know that the Supreme Court or the justices don't know? It seems to me that the Oklahoma justices were saying quite a bit that if they were to determine whether this execution was constitutional or not, they needed to know a lot more about what kind of drugs were being used and how they were being administered.
That's right. And the information out of Oklahoma is sort of dribbling out very slowly, little bits at a time. And the fact of the matter is that right now we don't know what happened to Clayton Lockett. We don't know what went wrong. And we won't know unless and until there's a thorough, transparent, and truly independent investigation of his execution. And Oklahoma must have that investigation if it wants to restore confidence in its, you know, in its ability to carry out death sentences in compliance with the law and in compliance with the Constitution.
Okay. And to follow up real quick, is Governor Fallon, are you satisfied with the moves she has made to conduct what she is calling an independent investigation, even though she has tapped a department that is within the executive branch to investigate the matter?
I think that's clear that that's not an independent investigation. We can look back to 2006 into 2007, following the torturous execution of Angel Diaz in Florida, Governor Jeb Bush created a governor's commission to study what went wrong in that execution. And while, you know, that commission and no commission is going to be perfect, we see there a real effort to bring in all sorts of different voices. So there were people from inside the administration, but there were also people outside the administration. There were medical doctors, there were defense attorneys, there were prosecutors. And it was a truly independent and very thorough investigation. They brought in a lot of witnesses to testify and to provide information. They talked to the medical examiner who did the autopsy. They talked to the execution team. And part of the benefit of having a truly independent investigation is that the execution team from Oklahoma would be able to speak freely about what they know and what went wrong. If the execution team feels that it's not an independent investigation, they can't feel safe and secure testifying to what happened. And, of course, if it's not a thorough, transparent, and independent investigation, none of us will ever know exactly what happened.
Thank you. Thank you. Dahlia, I want to turn back a little bit to the court situation here. What, if you can, succinctly tell us why Americans should be concerned that our courts act independently in a situation like this, regardless of what you think of the death penalty. Why should Americans be concerned that you've had a court refuse to or back away from trying to determine whether the Oklahoma planned executions were going to be carried out constitutionally?
Well, I mean, I think the two structural reasons are almost self-evident. One is that courts exist to be careful, meticulous, scrupulous, unbiased finders of fact. They're not policymakers. They're meant to look at a situation and say, what happened? And it's very, very hard to do that if when you come to a conclusion, and the Supreme Court came to a lengthy and thorough conclusion in Oklahoma that there were very, very pressing matters of constitutional concern, if that can just be erased by either a stroke of the governor's pen or articles of impeachment. So the other reason really is, and it's related to this, courts are meant to be the one piece of our government that is a counter-majoritarian check on the passions of the people. And so even if an action that the court takes is unpopular, and certainly I think in Oklahoma it was a very popular proposition to execute Clayton Lockett quickly, the court exists to say stop. If it's wrong, it's just wrong. And in a perfect world, the court doesn't answer for making decisions that are unpopular with majorities. That is the role of the executive. That's the role of the legislature. But if courts are basically hurled into the same situation that the governor and the legislature are in, which is you make a decision we don't like, we simply fire you, then the courts really not only can't do their jobs, but can't protect us from sometimes our worst impulses.
Okay. I appreciate both of you here. I want to give some folks a chance online to ask questions of both Dahlia and Megan. So if I get the moderator to find out if we have some questions coming in, I'd appreciate that.
Certainly, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question today, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. When you're on a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, for any questions at this time, please press star 1 now, and we'll pause for just a moment. And our first question will come from Corinne Lesnes from Limon.
Hi, thank you for doing this call. I wanted to focus a little bit on the role Europe is playing in this. I was wondering if that place, if that gives any kind of reaction to people to execute even with more determination, as you said. Is it in spite of Europe, you know, trying to tell us what we should not do? I mean, do you see any kind of reaction like this? Because I know that at some point, since Europe, European countries protest each time there's an execution, I know that some people in the States feel that this is very much an intrusion. So how do you feel about that, or is it just a private company's type of attitude in Europe?
Well, this is Megan. Should I go ahead and answer?
Go ahead, Megan.
Okay. You know, the EU does not have the death penalty, and it violates EU law for pharmaceutical companies there to provide drugs here. And so some of the laws that we see and some of the export limitations we've seen from the EU are protective of the EU and protective of their own company. And so although I think it can be perceived here as meddling on the part of European countries, there it's a self-protective move because of the laws in the EU. In terms of the pharmaceutical companies, you know, I think it's important to realize that major pharmaceutical companies have been asking for years for their drugs not to be used in executions. They've been sending letters to departments of corrections and to governors saying, this is not what we make our drugs for. Please do not use our products in executions. We make our products to help people, heal people, treat disease. And the states ignored their requests. And so over time, they decided to take firmer steps to prevent the use of their products in executions.
Thank you.
I might just add to that briefly that the same exact phenomenon that Megan is describing with respect to pharmaceuticals is the problem that we have now with medical professionals. Because of the Hippocratic Oath, because of the basic fundamental proposition that doctors and medical professionals exist to save lives, not to take lives, doctors are not necessarily involved in these lethal injection procedures, and many of them really are barred from doing it. And so what that means is you have corrections officials doing it. And certainly in the case of Clayton Lockett, they tried to inject him in a vein in his groin, which is something that is a complicated procedure, even for a physician, I think, relatively complicated. But I think that the exact same impulse that Megan is describing, which is that the folks who should be doing this at some level to make sure that it's being done right are benching themselves for moral and ethical reasons. And what that means is that what we get in its place is lesser quality, in this case, lesser quality medical expertise.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I agree completely. And I would just add that at the same time, even when medical professionals are participating, that is certainly no guarantee. We see in Oklahoma during Mr. Lockett's execution that a doctor was present and a doctor was involved in trying to figure out at least what was going wrong once the execution started, but also based on the timeline released by Director Patton from the Department of Corrections, that the doctor was involved in the siting of the IV. And so even having a medical professional involved is no guarantee of an incident-free execution. You need an execution team that is qualified and competent.
Do we have some other questions?
Yes, we'll go to our next question. That comes from Richard Wolf with USA Today.
Hey, thanks, everyone, for doing the call. I just have a quick question. There was a case on there was a cert grant, not a grant. There was a certiorari petition at the Supreme Court a few weeks ago out of Louisiana that was denied. Do either of you see another case like that getting to the Supreme Court? Is this something that the court will eventually have to address?
I would just briefly say, and Megan probably knows this better, but I think that we know that there are three justices who are interested in hearing one of these cases. I'm not sure that we've seen that there's a fourth. So I think that's one of the questions is whether there are enough justices to grant cert. But Megan may know what case is percolating.
Oh, no, I agree with that. And a lot of cases go up to the Supreme Court if they are in a stay posture, you know, if the execution is about to happen, and the court so far has not taken any of those cases. But I generally avoid tea leaf reading, so I can't say.
Good, thanks.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 now. And we do have a question from Zanelle October with American Constitution Society.
Hi. You guys sort of kind of already answered this, I think, but I just wanted to follow up. Who actually decides which drugs are being used in executions? Who buys those drugs, and to the extent that it's the state, is the state exempt from FDA and controlled substance regulations and laws in the buying of those drugs?
That's a good and pretty complicated question. Of course, each state has its own capital sentencing statutes, and the statutes generally give the Departments of Corrections in the state the power to craft the lethal injection protocols. And so you'll see differences in the way that the capital sentencing statutes will defer that regulation or rulemaking authority to the Department of Corrections. Some grant sort of wide discretion to fashion a lethal injection protocol. Other statutes give sort of more guidance, more guided discretion in terms of what the Department of Corrections can do. But in the end, it's going to be high-level folks from Departments of Corrections making the lethal injection protocol, coming up with the drugs, the doses, and the route of administration, who's on the execution team. And so each Department of Corrections has its own protocol, and it's made by the department. Because of the current degree of secrecy, very little is known about how that promulgation, how that rulemaking actually takes place. Is there consultation, you know, outside consultation? If so, with whom? Are medical professionals involved in that consultation, if it happens at all? Very little about that is known. We certainly see that states, in one way or another, share ideas with each other because we'll see common threads through the protocols. But there's very little transparency about how those protocols are actually developed. Oh, and I didn't address your second part of your question. So, yes, it, again, differs widely between the states, but some either Department of Correction official or someone within the state will be procuring the drugs for the Department of Corrections. We see in the state of Ohio that it's through the Department of Mental Health. In most places, we see that it's simply the Department of Corrections that's able to buy the drugs. Sometimes the drugs are going through the pharmacy, either in the prison or the department of pharmacy, sometimes not. There's really no consistency across the board there. But in order to buy controlled substances, you do need the appropriate DEA licenses. So there certainly is a DEA component to that.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 now. And our next question will come from Casey Lowe with California Western School of Law.
I agree with a lot, if not all, of what's been said here concerning the death penalty, concerning the Eighth Amendment, and especially concerns about judicial independence. So my question is, a law student who, of course, doesn't have as much experience, as a member of the progressive movement, you know, what can we do to reinforce these firewalls of judicial independence and protect the Eighth Amendment?
It's a really hard question, and in fact, you know, the unsung hero of this in terms of who the progressive movement should probably thank is Mary Fallon, because I think she probably, you know, Stephanie Mensimer has a good piece in Mother Jones, I think yesterday, saying she kind of single-handedly elevated this issue by, you know, overreaching and by rushing to do something that could have been done a little bit more deliberately. So I think this was a funny case in that just the utter, you know, horror of how it transpired has been probably good for progressives. You know, the short answer is probably that you know, the death penalty is absolutely losing support in this country. It still, you know, enjoys somewhere between 50% and 55% approval. That tends to be concentrated in the South, among older people, among white people. But I think there's reason to believe that because of these endemic problems, you know, because of the racial bias, because of the, you know, lack of really meaningful defense, because of just deep structural problems in the prosecutorial misconduct, police interrogations, innocent confessions. People, believe it or not, John Grisham has done just such a tremendous job of elevating these issues to public consciousness. And so I think that even Americans who believe passionately that the death penalty is appropriate, and even Barack Obama said last week that he believes that in some instances the death penalty is appropriate, the question is, I think for most people, quite clearly, even if we agree that we, you know, we can stipulate that we want the death penalty, the way it's being administered right now is horrifying. And you know, as I said at the opening, mistakes in this order of magnitude are not uncommon. And the veil of secrecy has exacerbated the problems rather than alleviating it. So I think that what progressives need to do is keep the focus on, you know, the flaws in the system, everything that Megan said about what is profoundly wrong with how the death penalty is administered. And then the much less sexy piece of that is to just constantly focus on judicial independence. Because I think that, you know, it's a paradox in this country that in states that elect judges and justices, people want to control their judicial branch and they want to punish their judicial branch for unpopular decisions. And that feels intuitively right to us. That feels democratic. But this is one of those cases where you can really see why efforts to tamp down on judicial independence sometimes backfire.
Thank you.
And next we have a question from Terrence Pitts with Open Society Foundations.
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, great. Thank you for having me. I wanted to know, for Megan and Dahlia, what you think about this as a potential opening for some sort of reform effort in the state of Oklahoma, for a study commission or a call, more permanent call for a moratorium in Oklahoma. If you think either of those two avenues would be viable, and if so, what would be needed, what kind of political pressure would be needed to make that happen?
Dahlia, do you want to go? Or
I would just say that, a state senator from Oklahoma did just call for a moratorium. I think I saw that only this morning. But certainly I think there's some impetus to push for that. Barack Obama has asked the Justice Department to do a deep study on, the death penalty as it's administered. Now, there's, query whether another study helps. I think we know what the problems are, but certainly I think there is at least some momentum for really, really scrutinizing what went wrong. I think that there are a lot of political reasons why Mary Fallon and other governors in death penalty states want to be, hard on crime, and they want to show that by executing more people faster. The last thing I would just say, and Megan made this point, but it's worth really flagging it, if the investigation that happens in Oklahoma is the one that's currently ongoing, which is, that the person who is conducting the investigation answers to the governor, works for the governor, and comes out of this corrections department, I think there's a real question about how independent that study will be. And so I think right now the big push, to the extent that there's a push in Oklahoma, is to make sure that that investigation is utterly independent of the governor's office and has the authority to really meaningfully investigate what happened.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I would add that the director of the Department of Corrections in Oklahoma, Mr. Patton, he has called for an indefinite stay on executions, and he has called for an independent investigation of what went wrong. And so if you have the top official of the Department of Corrections asking for that, I think that's a clear sign that it needs to happen. And I would also just point out that in January of this year, Oklahoma had another problematic execution. It was using a completely different drug protocol, and it was using compounded pentobarbital in the first of the three drugs. But there, Charles Wilson, shortly after the administration of the first drug, so it was the compounded pentobarbital, he cried out, "I feel my whole body burning." And those were his last words. And so twice already in 2014, Oklahoma has had problematic, to say the least, executions. And on top of that, we have the very troubling execution of Dennis McGuire in Ohio, also in January of this year, using yet another drug formula, drug combination. And so both in Oklahoma, but really everywhere, some due diligence is needed to really look at how executions are being carried out and what's going wrong.
Great, thank you.
And at this time, there are no further questions in the queue, and I'd like to turn the call back over to our speakers for any additional or closing remarks.
Okay, thank you. Dahlia, before I let you go, is President Obama, is his involvement here, evolution on the death penalty, going to be helpful in any way? Last week he did note the racial bias in the meting out of the death penalty. He seemed to have made comments that he's not made before regarding the death penalty. Is his involvement, is his comments here going to be helpful at all?
I think it's certainly helpful as far as it goes. I think it helped elevate this to, an urgent national question and an urgent policy question. And as I suggested, I think that the study that he's commissioned is going to reveal just deep, deep, systematic, probably unfixable problems with the way we administer the death penalty, and that's only to the good. I guess the real question is what happens after that investigation is done, whether, he's able to take the next step, which is to say, now it's time to fix it, and there are things we can do to fix it. But certainly I think the fact that almost immediately after the botched execution, he was able to stand up and say, look, I may think that executions are reserved for the worst of the worst, but not this way, I think is terrifically important, because I think it really does echo the sentiment of many, many, if not most Americans who think that, yes, the death penalty is appropriate, but what we're doing is tantamount to torture.
And one other thing, you alluded to this, about the money pouring into elections all over the country, including judicial elections. The U.S. Supreme Court hasn't been particularly helpful in this situation. Citizens United and then McCutcheon of this year has changed things drastically. How do we confront something like this?
It's an enormous problem, and it's a problem that gets much less attention than it should, because I think campaign finance reform, we tend to think of it, you know, just as regards to the legislative branches. But the truth is that we have seen unbelievable millions and millions and millions of dollars pouring into judicial races in the last few years, and it rises exponentially every year. And as I said, it's a really good deal. It is much, much cheaper and more cost efficient to remove a judge than it is to seat a legislator, and folks have figured that out. So it's unbelievable the pressure that members of the judiciary and states that elect judges are under, not just at the Supreme Court level, but at any level. And I think, you know, one thing we really need to have a conversation about is, you know, given that judges themselves in surveys say that this money, asking for this money and then having to decide cases in front of litigants who have paid this kind of money is, of course, not only affecting their impartiality, but affecting the appearance of impartiality. So judges are really in an absolutely impossible situation. And over and above that, you know, are stopped by judicial ethics rules from talking about any of this. So they cannot campaign, they cannot answer false charges against them. So the problem of money in judicial races is so much more pernicious and toxic even than money in just regular legislative races, and we really haven't had a serious conversation about how that impacts judges, the judicial branch, and judicial independence. So, you know, I think for me at least, the takeaway here is we need to think of ways to talk to American people about why, if you insist on electing judges and Supreme Court justices, understand that money in those races is going to undermine just the basic principles of why we have judges in the first place.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. And Megan, I want to give you a chance also just to wrap up and give us some thoughts of important takeaways from this situation, and maybe also what are some ways to bring some transparency to this situation. I think ProPublica today wrote something to the effect of bringing video monitoring into this matter. Do you have any comments regarding the transparency of states using combinations, lethal injection combinations?
Sure. I guess first I'd say that my takeaway from this situation, and so I'll just share it with you all, is that at this point we still don't know what happened to Mr. Clayton Lockett. And until we do, it's really hard to make good conclusions and to know what we need to change and to know what the takeaway is. And so we're all waiting to find out. We have some indications. We know that the IV was a problem. We know that they were using a novel combination of drugs. But we don't have answers. And unless and until we do, then it's very hard to make informed conclusions and to know where we go from here. In terms of transparency, I think that there are simple things. I don't know if simple is the right word. There are very straightforward, I guess, things that can be done, and then there are much more complicated things. You know, any drug protocol that calls for the use of a paralytic agent, that is simply adding a veil of secrecy over the execution. Once that paralytic is administered, really almost no one can know what happens after that. Certainly the people in the drug room who are pushing the drugs, they'll know when the drugs were pushed. They'll know maybe how the prisoner responded to the pushing of the drugs, but witnesses won't be able to tell what's going on. And unless they have highly qualified medical professionals, they won't be able to tell if the prisoner is, in fact, deeply anesthetized or actually conscious and suffering, you know, tremendous torture. So removing the paralytic agent is a straightforward improvement. The curtains are an easy way to increase transparency. Don't close them. The Ninth Circuit and then also Ohio requires that the witnesses be able to see the entire execution from the time that the prisoner enters the death chamber until the time he is declared dead. In Ohio, the sighting of the IVs is actually captured by closed-circuit television because that part does not take place in the execution chamber in Ohio. But at least for the states in the Ninth Circuit, the IVs are set in the execution chamber, and it's required that the curtains be open the entire time. The curtains were closed during Mr. Lockett's execution for 27 minutes before he was announced to have died. And so that is just a very straightforward, obvious way to prevent the witnesses from seeing what happened. More complicated transparency issues are the promulgation of the lethal injection protocols. Some states go through an administrative process if they are amending or promulgating a lethal injection protocol. That allows for public notice, public comment, a hearing, you know, real oversight, as would happen if a legislature were passing the rules. So APA laws are extraordinarily important. But in states where the Departments of Corrections are exempted from the APA, there still should be that level of openness, transparency, and public oversight to what's going on.
Okay. I want to thank both of our speakers today, Megan McCracken, the Eighth Amendment Resource Counsel at the UC Berkeley School of Law, and Dahlia Lithwick, who has been writing about states, about law and courts for Slate for quite some time. I greatly appreciate both of your time. This call was recorded and will soon be available on the ACS website, and we'll disseminate it on our Facebook page and our Twitter feed as well. Again, though, thank you both for taking the time to talk to us, and thanks to everybody who called in to listen to this. It's greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you.
And that does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for your participation.